Now then, Dimitri, you know how we've always talked about the possibility of something going wrong with the bomb. The bomb, Dimitri. The hydrogen bomb.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The thermonuclear paradox after 70 years is that those warheads, 17,000 of them still out there, have come to seem unusable in war, but also unshakable in peace. Barnacled old pros at nuclear strategy, Henry Kissinger in the lead, have turned abolitionist. Robert McNamara, too, spoke of apocalypse soon. And he shouted at us before he died, those nukes have to go, because the prolonged combination of human fallibility with unimaginable explosive power means doomsday, sooner, not later. And now comes the intrepid humanist, Elaine Scarry, who says just holding nuclear warheads under the finger of one chieftain is poison for people's rule anywhere, poison for democracy, poison for the social contract to keep the peace together. The end of the story, Elaine Scarry says, is it's the weapons or us. And job one is to get people's attention. On Boston Common this week, we asked people, who has the nukes after all?
Russia, Iraq,
Pakistan,
Soviet Union, South Korea.
Oh dear, Israel, Syria, Iran.
I think Russia and Iran.
Cuba still?
Cuba maybe.
Japan, US, Russia.
Iraq or Syria, Pakistan, I think.
I think Iraq might be trying to build some.
Russia, North Korea, Vietnam.
Probably Israel, too. We'll throw Israel in there.
We don't have any, right?
Either we wake up and get rid of them, Elaine Scarry says, or this nuclear model of monopolistic, secret control of the machines that can kill the planet will finish the job of smothering our Constitution, our common defenses, our last shred of free, responsible, self-respecting humanity. In Elaine Scarry's big new book called Thermonuclear Monarchy, Choosing Between Democracy and Doom, there's an activist pep talk for plain citizens, and there are angles and arguments you never thought of. In The Crunch, even at 9/11, Elaine Scarry will argue it's the people who defend the country, not the machines. Our phone is 800-423-8255 is the phone to join the conversation of around a way out of the nuclear age. Elaine Scarry, there's something deeply scary and cheerful about this book both. What are we drawing on here to get out of this abyss? And what have we lost in the meantime, including a kind of public awareness of our fate?
Well, we have a huge nuclear arsenal. The United States has the most powerful nuclear arsenal in the world by far. People often think that it came into being in the Cold War and that it's a residue of the Cold War. That is just factually inaccurate. We have a huge arsenal that has been made since the fall of the Berlin Wall. For example, we have 14 Ohio-class submarines. Each of them has the equivalent of 4,000 Hiroshima bombs, and 8 of those have been made since the opening of the Berlin Wall. The first was USS West Virginia, and the last in 1997 was christened and commissioned was USS Louisiana. And this in the 6 decades or 7 decades that we've had nuclear weapons, it's not just a physical architecture that is literally an architecture for massacre. It has no other function. It has no other purpose. It has also been accompanied by a mental architecture, which addresses your question. So, and in order, the mental architecture has required that we disable our understanding of our own constitution, of political philosophy, and first and foremost of the vitality of our own citizenry and their responsibility for defending the country.
You wrote an astonishing article right after 9/11, basically saying it was those passengers on Flight 93, the plane that went down in Pennsylvania, that knew something about reclaiming their lives. The Pentagon didn't. Are we still stuck in that general picture?
I think we are still stuck in that general picture, in part because nobody concluded from that event the fact that the passengers on Flight 93 were able to defend the country, did act to save people on the ground by deliberate getting information, conferring with one another, literally voting, and then acting to bring down the plane. They did all that in 23 minutes, whereas the Pentagon couldn't defend the Pentagon despite 50 minutes in which it knew that that was a hijacked plane. That is something that would be repairable if we as a country address the fact that on 9/11 the Pentagon couldn't defend the Pentagon because it had certain immediate announcement to us that we weren't thinking correctly about the source of defense. And there have been many events since 9/11 that again confirm the power of the citizenry to defend one another. For example, in 2001, the shoe bomber was apprehended by and stopped by a citizen. Again, the Detroit Christmas bomber in 2009 stopped by a citizen. 2010, Times Square, a vendor notices something wrong. So it would be hard for any military that has cut out its citizens to ever have the kind of expansive sensory acuity that a full citizenry can have. And
dare I mention, in the marathon crisis a year ago, it was a guy in his backyard who saw the body under the boat. I mean, with, you know, the whole world descending on the region.
That's a great example because, of course, it was a lockdown, which was, of course, benignly intended and to keep people out of harm's way. And yet, as you say, it was an ordinary person, one of us.
But what is that ordinary energy that you're basing all the hope on, that we could somehow reactivate, that we could somehow engage?
Well, a lot of time it just is activated on its own. It doesn't require any call,
yes,
any official. So just if I can give one more example. When
please,
the Columbia space shuttle went down in 2003, NASA was able to recreate the whole flight path as it disassembled, not by its own cameras, but because amateur sky watchers, amateur astronomers all across the country were watching the sky and watching the space shuttle. And so NASA scientists said, these people are our heroes. They got the whole picture. And there are many other examples of that. But the citizenry has been put aside. I mean, we allowed the draft to be eliminated. Mm-hmm. And it's been widely observed that when the country goes off to war, whether in Iraq or Afghanistan, the citizenry has nothing to say about it and feels it has nothing to say about it. It feels that it will turn on the radio or the television to learn whether we're at war rather than deliberating with one another, listening to the reasons, testing it, seeing if it makes sense. Many people have observed the fact that the very few people in Congress or in universities, for example, either themselves or have children who are in the military.
Elaine Scarry, I mean, your genius for me over years of reading and listening is your genius is for reframing the picture. You have a lot of fun in this book with a reproductive analogy. It's mamas and papas, you know, acting on their own impulses that regenerate the population. Although you point out, you know, it could be put under government control, even one man's control, test tubes and sperm banks and the works. You say, as we all would, you can't possibly make a new generation that way. We wouldn't want to. But we do make our so-called common defense that way. Your point being we need distribution of initiatives, of responsibilities, of taxes, of literacy, of judgment, of the whole thing. And yet that's not the way we do it. In this kind of military game, how would you break it? Especially when the logic of the machinery itself puts tighter and tighter focus on the power.
Right. So, well, I mean, as you say, we've over many decades come to be used to the fact that we've lost the power of self-defense, that we've ceded the power of self-defense. In the initial years of nuclear weapons, there was an outcry about it. There was continual alarm about it. And now people have just grown used to the fact that they don't have any responsibility for the defense of the country. And traditionally, by the way, the civic stature always followed from military responsibilities. For example, the 15th Amendment extending the right to vote to African Americans was argued primarily on the basis that 190,000 blacks had fought in the Civil War. 19th Amendment extending the vote to women also relied a lot on women's power of self-defense. 26th Amendment lowering the voting age from 21 to 18 is argued on the basis that both soldiers in Vietnam and people on university campuses had taken incredible responsibility for thinking about the war. And people in the Congress actually said, this generation has earned for itself and later generations the right to vote at a younger age. If we've now lost and not only lost the right of self-defense and the capacity for self-defense, but even the awareness that we've lost it.
Yes.
And that's the point of the analogy to what would happen if we lost the right of self-reproduction, of a population reproducing itself. We can see that would be an outrage, but 6 decades later, we might say, well, you know, there's certain advantages to that.
Well, it's cautionary. Habits, instincts, identities do atrophy over 70 years.
Right.
I keep thinking, it's your suggestion, but that Switzerland doesn't do nuclear weapons, but they do shelters. Imagine Swiss survivors coming out of their holes after the wreckage of a nuclear war. What would they say about how the participants had conditioned themselves for ruin? What's happened to us?
Well, they have a very strong ethic that it goes under the rubric equality of survival. If you believe in equality, you show that first and foremost by distributing to the population an equal capacity for survival. And that's why they have a requirement that every house have a fall shelter. That's why they have hospitals buried in many mountains. That's why they practice many days a year, even protecting their cultural objects. And one point the book makes is that it's not that Switzerland spends money on civil defense and we don't. We both spend an equal amount of money, but they spend it on all their citizens, whereas we spend it on a fallout shelter for our president in Mount Weather in the Blue Ridge Mountains.
I wonder, I put it to listeners and citizens, have we, the people, traded away our control of nuclear weapons to a nuclear monarchy, to an imperial presidency? We're in conversation with Elaine Scarry, a wide-ranging literature scholar at Harvard, about monarchy, monopoly in the custody of our nuclear Armageddon. Here is how the nuclear age began in August 1945, when President Harry Truman told the world about the American bomb just dropped on the Japanese city of Hiroshima.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima and destroyed its usefulness to the enemy. That bomb has more power than 20,000 tons of TNT. It is an atomic bomb. It is a harnessing of the basic power of the universe. The force from which the sun draws its power has been loosed against those who brought war to the Far East. We have spent more than $2 billion on the greatest scientific gamble in history, and we have won.
Our phone is 800-423-8255. Are we not stuck in that dubious victory? After a 70-year transformation of war and peace, power and fear on the planet, can we imagine an end of the nuclear age? Hugh Gustafson is a nosy citizen in the field, an anthropologist based at George Mason University, who's made a career of asking, what are people actually doing out there in nuclear bomb work, and why do they say they're doing it? He's the author of People of the Bomb and Nuclear Rights. Speak to the democracy or doom question for starters, Hugh. I mean, when the irresistible energy of democracy and self-assertion meets the immovable force of the nuclear establishment, what happens?
Well, I was very glad that you played this speech by Truman. Because if you want to talk about the disconnect around democracy with nuclear weapons, Truman is a key figure. When Truman was vice president, he had no idea that the Manhattan Project existed. The vice president of the United States had not been told that there was this, the most expensive public works project in American history, to develop the superbomb. And when Roosevelt died, he had to be told that this weapon existed. Of course, no one consulted the American people about dropping the bomb. A genocidal act was carried out in the name of the American people, and they were told about it afterwards. So that gives some example of some sense of the way in which nuclear weapons can be incompatible with democracy. We now live in a situation where, although the Constitution says that the right to declare war is lodged with the people, and the War Powers Act reaffirmed that, in practice, because a Russian nuclear weapon could arrive with only 15 to 20 minutes warning, the right to use nuclear weapons, which would kill tens of millions of people in other countries, is delegated to the American president. Congress would not be involved if the president made an emergency decision to use those weapons. And there has been an instance with Nixon when he was president where Kissinger was so worried that the president had become mentally imbalanced that he quietly put the word around that if Nixon gave any order to put the weapons on alert or to use them, people were to come to Kissinger first.
What has this done to us? And you're the kind of guy that snoops around and observes 70 years under a kind of, enforced blindness and abject fear. Where are we?
I think it's made the American people spectators around weaponry and around war, which I think is one of the points Elaine is trying to get across. I'm always struck when I go to the movies and I look at the trailers how mass mayhem and death and weaponry are so aestheticized for us to watch. In the era of drones, it's as if American bodies don't even have to be in the theater of war. The American people are becoming disconnected from the weaponry that's used in their name and on their behalf. With drones, there's even the possibility that no Americans could die in the theater of war. There's this passivity, which Elaine is talking about. And I think it becomes very difficult for the American people to be aware of the basic facts and to do what the distinguished psychoanalyst Robert J. Lifton calls imagining the real. I was struck by those voices you played at the beginning of the show, where you asked people who has nuclear weapons. Many of the countries that you played for us, Vietnam, Syria, Cuba, Iraq, Iran, do not have nuclear weapons. There are countries that do that the people you interviewed didn't mention, particularly
we don't have them, right? I mean, I love that line.
Yeah. Britain wasn't mentioned. France.
Okay,
wasn't mentioned.
The patient out of the cave. I mean, where do you start, Elaine or Hugh?
What I argue in my book is that there are two crucial provisions in the Constitution that are designed to oversee the country's entry into war. Both of them require that the authorization of going to war be widely distributed. The first is the requirement, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11, that requires a congressional declaration of war. Since the invention of atomic weapons, we have not had a declaration of war because presidents feel, given that they have this colossal nuclear power, certainly they don't have to go to Congress merely to invade Haiti or Panama or
Iraq.
And
of course, we wouldn't have time, people say.
We wouldn't have time. Well, even in conventional war, they say they don't have time. The closest thing we had was a conditional declaration in the first Gulf War, but in earlier moments in history when we had a congressional declaration, the conditional declaration was always judged to be an illegitimate speech act, not a legitimate form of going to war. The incompatibility between that constitutional requirement and our present arrangements for presidential first use of nuclear weapons has been very widely observed in law journals, foreign policy journals. Even presidents themselves have observed it. Eisenhower, who considered using atomic weapons in the Taiwan Straits crisis in 54 and again in Berlin in 59, said that he would be impeached if he did it without Congress, but that he was willing to be impeached. The second provision that is absolutely crucial But you know, maybe not as widely recognized as bearing on this issue is the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms. Right now in this country, people are divided between one group that passionately believes in the right to bear arms as an individual right, and then the other half of the population that has disdain for the right to bear arms and won't pay attention to it. But actually, the right to bear arms is a very great amendment that tries to hold military power within a civil frame by saying however much military power you have, it has to be equally distributed across the population. That can sound like a wholly military provision, but even great pacifists like Gandhi have believed in it. For example, he said, of all the evil deeds committed by England against India, the worst was the disarming of the population. Give us back our arms, and then we'll tell you whether we're going to use them.
So we made them helpless. We're talking about a half-atrophied mind and body and identity in this country, and it's rampant, you say. How do you bring it back, as you suggest, to the real?
I think that by people first understanding that we have this huge arsenal, second, that at least 10 times our presidents have contemplated seriously using them, that there's always a big time lag between when the president considers using them and when we find out about it, often 30 or 40 years passes. By realizing those two things and then realizing that we have the constitutional tools to actually require that nuclear weapons be eliminated, and bringing that to bear on the problem, we can actually put pressure on the government to eliminate them.
We who? We in the streets, we in the upper reaches of academia, we in the book trade. Where does it begin?
We everywhere. We the people who were watching the sky that night when the shuttle went down. We the people who, like wildflowers. We the people who have been looking at the snowy owl, immigration into the country this year. We who believe that colonization isn't right and yet have seen our own government explode 66 atomic bombs in Bikini. We who believe in the equality of genders and the importance of women's voices having an equal play. We who believe that it isn't just people. Right now, we have a belief in this country that only if you have had close proximity to nuclear weapons, if you've manned a missile silo or you've been Secretary of Defense, does your opinion about this scandalous condition have any standing? And I'm deeply grateful for all those people like Robert McNamara or Paul Nitze, who said we should undergo unilateral disarmament right away, for all those people who speak out. But we ought to understand that the millions of inhabitants of Earth who stand to be slain have a voice too. And the evidence.
The people on your block know better. I mean, it's on my block, but how's to mobilize them? How's to mobilize us, commonsensical people who say no? And it's a huge percentage, a huge majority that would happily be done with nuclear weapons tomorrow.
I think something has happened.
Hugh Gustafson.
I studied the anti-nuclear movement of the 1980s as well as the nuclear weapons scientists. And one of the striking things about that grassroots movement, the Nuclear Freeze campaign in the 1980s, is that people went out and educated themselves about the basic facts of the arms race. They started to produce their own literature that you could find in bookstores, a gray literature of pamphlets that they were distributing. And you would go to church basements and places like that, and you would find people gathering, watching documentary films that had been made. They had a guest speaker, and people knew which countries in the world had nuclear weapons. They knew how many nuclear weapons. They knew something about nuclear use doctrine and so on. Part of that grassroots movement was that people informed themselves. They didn't take the word of Yale professors of strategy for it. They produced their own knowledge and their own literature. And we've lost that. And I think with the end of the Cold War, the American people somehow lapsed into this fantasy that nuclear weapons were gone, that they'd somehow disappeared with the Soviet Union. I find that my own students are often not sure how many nuclear weapons the U.S. has. It has about 1,500 deployed right now, by the way. My own students will guess far fewer numbers than that usually. So there's this sense that somehow the end of the Cold War solved the problem. And that fragile accomplishment of a citizenry that had informed itself dissipated. One more thing, if I could add it. We've been talking about the danger of presidents using nuclear weapons, and it certainly has been a real danger at certain key points. We haven't talked about the danger of an accidental detonation. And many nuclear experts are more concerned about that. Mm. Eric Schlosser, the journalist, just published a fine book, Command and Control, that's structured around this extended narrative of a terrifying accident in Arkansas in the 1980s, where we almost lost the state of Arkansas to a hydrogen bomb.
Because a guy's wrench fell 75 feet and practically melted down the core of the state. We've got a long, wonderful interview with Eric Schlosser on our website. I want you to check it. But
and in 1980, there was another incident in North Dakota where a B-52 carrying nuclear weapons caught fire on the runway. And a simulation that was later done by the Lawrence Livermore Lab concluded that had the wind been blowing in the other direction, there would have been a nuclear detonation in North Dakota.
We have these close calls. We also have these pratfalls. I mean, Bill Clinton losing his card, you know, in an elastic band with his American Express card or whatever, couldn't find it. Those don't need to be belabored, although maybe we should hear about them each time it happens. What strikes me, though, that there is a fundamental sort of madness, and I want you to unpeel it a little bit, Hugh. Our Cuba policy just goes right on as if the Cold War were raging. Our modernization of these Ohio submarines continues on a schedule into the middle of this century as if it's entirely on its own. We have, as you say, commissioned 8 new Ohio-class submarines, each with vastly more destructive power than Hiroshima, since the Cold War. I mean, hello? But you've lived among the scientists, Hugh, and it fascinates me. It seems to me they may be the models of the civic madness of as men and women, I'm sure, who bring incredible minds and deep integrity and probably some satisfaction to refining weapons that can never be used. That way, would seem to me, lies nuttiness.
Well,
but aren't we all in it with them?
I bristle or hesitate a little when I hear you use words like nuttiness and madness, because I think of the people who I lived among for 2 or 3 years who designed the weapons at the Los Alamos Lab and the Lawrence Livermore National Lab. And they're good, decent, earnest people.
I'm sure.
I found many of them were committed Christians. I'm not saying that's good or bad. Los Alamos, interestingly enough, has more PhDs per capita than any other community in the country and more churches per capita than any other community in the country. I once gave a talk.
And yet they're still in a trap, right?
They have faith in God, but faith in humanity. And maybe that's the problem. I don't know.
But they're working with machines that cannot be used.
I once gave a talk at Livermore, and I tried to explain to the Livermore scientists that many people had become anti-nuclear activists because they'd had nightmares about nuclear war. And one of the scientists came up to me afterwards and said, you know, I felt so sad when you said that. I feel really bad that there are these people who are having nightmares, and it's irrational. They don't need to have nightmares. The weapons won't be used. And I asked this group of about 100 weapons scientists listening to my talk how many of them had ever had a nightmare about nuclear war. And I think maybe 2 people out of 100 put their hands up. Many times in the interviews, I would ask people, do you expect a nuclear weapon to be used in your lifetime? And I almost always got the same answer, never. And then a pause, and well, maybe by India or Pakistan, some country like that, but never by the U.S., never by the Russians. You know, this is just a way of deterring one another. It's a game. We're not going to use the weapons. And I think ethically, they felt that they could only work on the weapons precisely because they were so persuaded that they would not be used. One of the weapons designers I knew had been a protester against the Vietnam War when he was a graduate student at Cornell, and he went from that to working on nuclear warheads at Livermore. And I said, isn't there some sort of disconnect there? And he said, no, I'm still for peace. He said, I could never work on landmines. I could never work on napalm. I could never work on a conventional cruise weapon because those are made to kill people, to maim people. The weapons that I designed saved millions of lives by preventing World War III. They'll never be used. They're pacifist bombs.
Elaine Scarry, do you want to?
Well, that's why it's important to become aware of the number of times presidents have considered using them. So let's just enumerate them. So Eisenhower, 1954 Taiwan strikes, Eisenhower, 1959 Berlin, Kennedy, we know from Robert McNamara, from the Earl Morris Fog of War film, McNamara said Kennedy three times.
Three times with Russia.
Three times came within a hairbreadth with Russia. Lyndon Johnson considered using them against China to prevent China from acquiring nuclear weapons. Nixon said he used them, considered using them four times, three times in addition to Vietnam. And what do we mean by contemplated using them? It's not just an airy idea that floats. For example, Nixon at one point had 18 B-52s loaded with nuclear weapons flying all the way over to Russia in a kind of bluff to Vietnam, but that's getting a very dangerous form of bluff because the nuclear weapons were actually loaded and on board. Now, the reason the list stops there is because there's a time lag of several decades between presidents contemplating things and their presidential papers being released. So we just have to contemplate the things that such events, such as the one that Joseph Gerson points out in one of his books, that in the first Gulf War we had 1,000 nuclear missiles around Iraq. Or again, on the day of 9/11, President Bush stopped at Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska. And prior to 9/11, when Offutt was ever talked about in the press, it was acknowledged that that was the nerve center of our nuclear strike power. Interestingly, not just against states, but against terrorists, whatever that could mean. How could you use a nuclear weapon against millions of people if it's a handful of terrorists who have committed the evil act?
I think there's another reason why we don't know of more threats, which is that a taboo has emerged against even the testing of the weapons and certainly the use of them. And one of the reasons senior nuclear strategists can even talk about abolishing them is that there is a question of whether they serve any use anymore.
If you had your way, if the people had their way with nuclear weapons, where would we be? Here's a sampling of Vox Pop on Boston Common this week.
There's no reason that the United States should have them and then tell other countries they cannot. But I do feel that other countries cannot have them. I mean, it's just feels to me like it's a dated form of warfare.
I just don't know. I just, you know, the thought of one man, you know, being in control of, you know, the nuclear arsenal and he can launch it whenever he wants is just kind of terrifying to me.
I think we should try and come up with some type of treaty where we all get rid of all of our nuclear arms and hold everyone to it.
I think I believe that they won't push the button because it destroys all mankind.
Mankind is failure prone. Malevolence has been with us since the days of humankind. It's our species. It's built into the genes.
If anybody has them, I guess others have to have them too, just to keep everybody behaving well. If all the women of the world would get together, we could get rid of them in no time.
Our guests are Elaine Scarry and Hugh Gusterson. You know, just in general, when we're stuck so long in the same old trap, we start saying there's a failure of imagination here, a kind of monopoly of bad thinking that would not be allowed among creative people in other fields. Hugh Gusterson, if you wanted to turn this nuclear puzzle to the best imaginations we know, where would you go?
Well, if you want the American people to care about the issue again, you have to make Hollywood movies about it.
I was going to say Hollywood. Good idea.
That's how the American people imagine the real, is through Hollywood.
The day after was credited with changing Ronald Reagan's mind. The movie Her has changed my mind about everything. But what are the possibilities?
We need Bob Scorsese to stop making movies about Wall Street and start making movies about nuclear war.
Elaine, can you imagine the script? Can you imagine the reframing? Can you imagine the fantasy?
Well, I think that the film Countdown to Zero, which was a documentary, and at least when I went, did not have many people in the theater, but I thought it was a brilliant documentary. And I'm used to this information, and I was quaking in my seat. It was a film that focused on accident rather than on intentional use by state power. And I think it's important for films to also concentrate on what the so-called legitimate use, because many people recognize the possibility of accident, they recognize the possibility of terrorists getting it, and they recognize the possibility of rogue states getting it. But the weapons remain in place because sometimes people, happily not the listeners that you just played the tape of, but many times people think that there's some legitimate use for it. How can there be any legitimate use for it? Whether Beijing is destroyed by terrorists or by an American president or by a British president, a British prime minister, how could that be anything other than the worst thing that ever happened?
And I think it is important for your listeners to know an important development over the last decade, which is that American national security elites have become fundamentally divided about nuclear weapons. Throughout the Cold War, American national security elites had a strong consensus that nuclear weapons were needed. They might have disagreed about the details of particular arms control treaties and so on, but there was a consensus that nuclear weapons and deterrence were essential for the security of the country. That is no longer the case. There are some very senior members of the American national security elite who have now come out for the abolition of nuclear weapons, writing op-eds in the Wall Street Journal. And I'm thinking here of Henry Kissinger.
I was going to say, do I trust myself for agreeing with Henry Kissinger on this one?
Sam Nunn, who was chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Bill Perry, who was Secretary of Defense, and George Shultz, who was Republican Secretary of State.
What does that tell you?
It tells me that national security elites are not sure that nuclear weapons serve any real purpose. The weapons have become about themselves now. In the absence of a Soviet enemy, in the absence of the Cold War and a bipolar arms race, we have the weapons because we don't have the imagination to know how to do away with them. We're afraid that the knowledge is out there that other countries have them, and so we can't imagine a way through to getting rid of them. But increasingly, certain members of the national security elite, like Kissinger and Nunn and Shultz and Perry, are worried that as long as the weapons exist, there's a risk of an accident with one, and there's a risk of a weapon falling into the wrong hands, by which I mean Al-Qaeda, and then you lose an American city. And that's what's fundamentally driving them. They think the real danger of the weapons now is them falling into the hands of terrorists. And since they're no longer really deterring another superpower, maybe we can figure out some way to reduce the numbers or even get rid of them.
We're talking about 70 years of a nuclear regime, nightmares, and maybe fixes. The phone's 800-423-8255. Dan is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Welcome, Dan.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thanks. Couple of quick points. Maybe it's getting less the case, but nuclear weapons are used, as are the out of ratio power that states have with weaponry in order to facilitate the use of other forms of violence in their neighborhood or beyond their neighborhood. That's number one. And I wanted to ask the Elaine Scarry. I read On Beauty and Being Just 10 years ago and was really affected. I was very moved by it for what it seems to be your project again in a more specific way, and that is to introduce people to their innate capacity to, in the earlier book, to know beauty, to know justice, and to know fairness, and to get to an unselfing sense of it that you talk about really beautifully. Can you talk about how this book has continued that, or has it?
There's a kinship. Dan, you're an acute reader. Thank you. Elaine Scarry.
Yeah, you're a wonderful, you're a generous reader and an acute reader. It does continue the theme because the argument in the second part of On Beauty is that certain features such as symmetry and beauty are anticipatory of our quest for justice in the political realm and the ethical realm. And of course, as you said, these weapons are an extreme example of the asymmetrical. I mean, the power that we have and the way in which it's made us deaf to other human beings, as in 1995 when 78 countries went to the International Court of Justice and pleaded with the court to have nuclear weapons declared illegal. Mm-hmm. And they quoted lots of international covenants, Hague, Geneva, the underlying philosophy of the UN, the conventions against genocide, conventions on the environment, and our government in both a joint statement of both the Department of Defense and the Department of State argued that having nuclear weapons, threatening to use nuclear weapons, using nuclear weapons, and using nuclear weapons first did not violate Hague, Geneva, UN, or any of the other covenants, including the covenant prohibiting genocide. So very much this is a continuation, and thank you very much for your reading.
Janet makes a wonderful point. A lot of our best instincts are universal. How do we draw on them? And again, I wonder on the reproductive analogy, Elaine, what is it about all of us that would laugh down the idea of preempting, you know, the normal biology of replacing a population, and that we're cowed for 70 bloody years on this question of military control?
Well, I think that, you know, as Hugh was saying a few minutes ago, in the initial years, people were not cowed. They really spoke out, and they really expressed their alarm. And they've just, you can only feel infantilized and helpless so long, and then you begin to change your descriptive accounts. So you say, well, as some of your earlier people did, that we don't have them, or if we have them, we would never use them. Or they are just there for some kind of threat, but wouldn't actually be used. But you know, in the analogy with replication, I think that if the state took over our powers of reproduction, in the first two, even three decades, people would be just astonished and would do everything possible to stop it.
You make the point in the book, Elaine, that we laughed out of court the whole Nixonian notion of these Transylvanian costumes around the White House guards. This was an absurdity from
right.
day one.
Right.
And yet it's a reflection of the same kind of imperial notion that we put up with in the management of the nukes. I have a question for Hugh on two different levels. If we don't rise up in rebellion against all this, there are two other things one can think of immediately. First, middle-sized, smart nations that have taken a look at nuclear weapons and said, thanks, but no thanks. The CIA says there are 40 countries out there that could easily muster the technology and the management to be nuclear powers, but there are only 8 that actually are. What can we learn from the ones who don't want them? Secondly, what is the pressure that non-nuclear countries, the vast mass of humanity, can exert on us to do something?
Well, I think a lot of countries have decided that to have nuclear weapons is to paint a bullseye on yourself. when I talk to people in Mexico and Brazil and Switzerland, they don't feel endangered by not having nuclear weapons. They often feel they're sort of out of the line of fire. And nuclear weapons are very expensive to produce and to maintain, so they can devote their
incredibly
national treasure to other purposes. We spend $7.5 billion a year right now on the weapons labs alone. In terms of pressures from other parts of the international system to move the established nuclear powers towards abolition, you know, in the Non-Proliferation Treaty signed in 1968, Article 6 of that treaty committed the established nuclear powers to working in good faith towards nuclear disarmament. The other countries of the world agreed not to acquire nuclear weapons, and in exchange, the established nuclear powers agreed that eventually they would get rid of their nuclear weapons. The other countries in the world are losing patience. That was 1968. The U.S. made that promise. And we have far fewer nuclear weapons than we had then. At the height, the U.S. stockpile is 30,000 or so. Now it's 1,500. But still, there's no sign of abolition on the horizon. There is an interesting initiative from countries like Mexico, Indonesia, Brazil, and so on. They recently had an international conference at Nayarit in Mexico
yes.
to draft a nuclear weapons convention. A convention that would be like the Landmine Convention or the Cluster Bomb Treaty, saying that these weapons are inherently genocidal weapons, their use would be a humanitarian catastrophe, therefore they should be illegal as a matter of principle and a matter of international law. The established nuclear powers boycotted those meetings. There's going to be another one in Vienna next year. Britain, America, Russia, and so on are very nervous about this diplomatic development. But it is a very interesting development to see whether that could be a way of pushing the nuclear powers.
I want us all to hear, before we're done, from J. Robert Oppenheimer, who had a big hand in making the bomb and then an immortal kind of definition of what it was that had happened.
Few people laughed. Few people cried. Most people were silent. I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita, his duty, and to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." I suppose we all thought that one way or another.
Elaine Scarry, if we did get rid of the last bomb, we'd still know how to make the next one. And we'd have learned something fundamental about a kind of both murderous and suicidal impulse that's in there in the human mix. What do we do about it? What is Oppenheimer suggesting?
Well,
become death.
Yeah. I think that people often say that because we have the knowledge to make them, we can't unmake our knowledge, and therefore we're...
I didn't mean that either, though.
You didn't? No.
If I can just add, the knowledge will always be there. It's the material that's hard to get.
Yeah.
You can have the knowledge, it's useless without the material. You need highly enriched uranium, which is expensive and difficult to acquire, plutonium, which doesn't exist in nature. That's the route to control.
And there's an article that I find very important by Bill Joy in the year 2000 in Wired magazine, where he puts forward the astonishing thesis that someday robots will have so much power and knowledge built into them that they will rebel against us and harm us, and we won't be able to harm them. And it sounds like a crazy science fiction theory until he says the prototype is already here, nuclear weapons, because they can literally extinguish us, and we seem to be unable to extinguish them. It can't be that we've made this thing that we can't unmake. We can surely unmake it, but we've got to stop repeating the words that we can't unmake it.
But I think maybe we've learned something about ourselves, something, and it's not just the materials. It's we have learned our infinite destructive energy, mischief, power, and somehow seeing that is cautionary, maybe even curative. I keep thinking of... Dr. Mukherjee's line toward the end of his book on cancer, The Emperor of All Maladies. Cancer is not a particular thing. You can't cut it out and kill it forever. It's in the potential for cancer is in every cell of all of our bodies forever. So is the generative power of stem cells that can bring, find new life, new shape, new forms, almost in an infinite way, that there is this kind of extremely precarious tension, balance. But once we've seen them both, we know much better where we are and what kinds of folly to avoid. Is that not a kind of step up toward a brighter day?
I can see your way of seeing it. The one thing I would say is that from the beginning of time, we've had accounts like the poem Gilgamesh or the Iliad that tell us that we've got an unbelievable capacity for what Alan Grossman, the poet, calls obliterative rage. And
now we're talking, yes.
Yeah, now and of course these weapons have literalized it because they enable a king not just to dream that he has the power to kill the whole citizenry as well as every other species, but the actual ability to do it.
Thank you, Elaine Scarry. Thank you, Hugh Gusterson. Listeners, you can continue the conversation about nuclear weapons on our website, radioopensource.org. You'll find interviews on our page with the Pulitzer Prize historian Richard Rhodes, who wrote The Making of the Atomic Bomb, also with the journalist Eric Schlosser, and his top 10 list of hair-raising nuclear near misses. There's another series of infographics on the page from our very own Max Larkin, and lots more. We're going out on a blues from Charles Mingus, "Oh Lord, Don't Let Them Drop That Atomic Bomb on Me," from 1962, if you can believe it. Thanks to George Hicks, Kunal Jasti, Max Larkin. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source. Drop it.
Don't let him drop it. Stop it. Bebop it. On me.